Mach jetzt mal den Gelben. Gelben? Das geht nicht schon mal. Okay, we're running behind time, so I'll do my very best to keep the time during this talk. So first of all, I'm going to talk to you about single atom nanoelectronics for slicking phase qubits, which is basically a progress report on a lot of work that's happened, particularly over the last year. We've had some good success, finally, after an intense effort. I want to say something about the people who are largely responsible for this work. To start off with, Rolf Brenner and Søren Andersen are two senior postdoctoral fellows in our centre who unfortunately aren't here at this meeting because they're actually doing measurements at the moment. And the coding here is basically the blue and the red indicate that they do both fabrication and measurement. And the fabrication program on the nanoelectronics side is coordinated by by Professor Andrew Zurak, my colleague at the University of New South Wales. And I look after the quantum measurement program, but I'm strongly assisted with Dr. Andrew Ferguson, who's at the coalface, who you've heard of here. And basically, these three very talented postdocs do both fabrication and measurement. At the University of Melbourne, the single ion implantation is done in the group with Professor David Jamieson, and the key people here are Chen Yang, Toby Hock, and Grigori Tamamian. And we are ably assisted, it's almost invaluable, by this beautiful theory group run by Professor Lloyd Hollenberg and his postdoc, Ken Lollard. And it's a real team effort, basically, between the University of Melbourne and the University of New South Wales. We're funded by the Australian Research Council. We also receive additional funds from the Australian government. And I'd particularly like to thank our funding from the US, which we've now had for 7 continuous years, from the National Security Agency, which comes to us through the Army Research Office. Okay. So I'm going to be talking about top-down fabrication. We've heard a very nice talk from Michelle on the bottom-up approach. This is a parallel approach in our centre. And basically, the nanofabrication is done in our clean rooms at the University of New South Wales, and the single ion implantation is done in the clean rooms at the University of Melbourne. And the quantum measurement is done in the quantum measurement lab at the University of New South Wales. Okay, now, just a little bit about top-down and how we make these atoms. This is a sort of fairly old overhead, just to show you this really is top-down. Here's a fabrication sort of moving in towards the device. Finally, we end up at the bottom end where we can see what's actually been made. And this is an old architecture where essentially we are putting out two atoms through nanoapertures, which I'll describe. These are the control gates to move an electron between these two atoms. These are single electron transistors with antennae, which are capacitively coupled to the two atoms, and these are the SET gates. And the key experiment we wanted to do initially was to make a two phosphorus atom device to remove one electron from that device to create a charged qubit, PP plus or artificial H2 plus molecule. So we have one electron that can sit either left or right or in symmetric or antisymmetric states. Towards the end of the talk, I'll tell you how this very device will take us to a spin qubit. Okay. Now, just a word on fabrication. David Jamieson, if you were here, could give a whole talk on this. We basically, this is a device, high resistivity intrinsic silicon. We have these contacts. This is a PIN structure set well back from where we actually building the quantum computer component. We have a back gate. We put minus 10 volts across this sample. We have a 150 nanometer PNMA resist. With low energy ion implantation, these apertures here are somewhere between 15 and 20 nanometers. We expose the beam to this area. When an atom finds its way through an aperture, it creates electron hole pairs of order a few hundred by collision with the silicon. It also loses energy through other mechanisms like nuclear stopping, etc., which we don't measure. And this voltage separates the electrons in the holes, to give us a click in a cooled external circuit and amplified circuit. And we can actually put this on a microphone and hear the zones counting one at a time. When we hear two clicks, we deflect the beam, and then we know we've made a two-atom device. These are non-deterministic at the moment in that two atoms could go down one hole or both down the same hole, but we have I won't be able to talk about this, but we have a phosphorus-focused ion beam project with Stephen Prowse coordinating, which is very close to coming along, which will be deterministic down the trial. Okay, so that's basically how we get the atoms in this top-down approach. And then we have actually changed the architecture of the device because we want to do microwave spectroscopy, which I'll come on to. So here we have the two apertures. This is a control gate, which is a very fast gate line in a coplanar architecture. These are the ground planes. Here now is our single electron transistor capacitor decoupled to this charged qubit with the SET gate. So this is the structure that we're actually building at the moment. Just to show you that this isn't sort of, you know, one device every 6 months or so. We're actually building these on chips where we have some 40 devices at a time and fabricated. This little sector here will be a two-atom device, for example, and here are the two-atom counts that characterize that particular implantation in that sort of pixel. Then we move on to the other pixel and finally we prepare the whole chip, which then gets diced up, and extensive experiments are done. We can make four-atom devices, five-atom devices. For the experimentalists, this is what the chip looks like, and you can see just a little bit of wiring going through the detector structure to get our full circuit and our signal. Okay, now I want to sort of step back before I go to the two atoms and just come back to this beautiful work by Victor Chan, who's here. And this is, when you're trying to move one electron between two atoms and look at this capacitive recoupling, you want to have a little bit of confidence that all of this phosphorus ion implantation followed by anneals, etc., really does work at a sort of slightly bigger level. And our idea was to build largely bigger clusters of ion implanted phosphorus so that we could see one electron go, then another, and see this periodic effect that we can control and actually establish the charging diagram. So as you saw from phase talk, these are large clusters with 100 nanometer gaps. They're in the classical density of states regime. So coming back to Kent Schuller's sort of comment that sometimes you want to see a classical effect, very much these are doped above a metal insulator transition, so 10 to the 19 for cubic centimeter, for example, of order, about an order of magnitude above the metal insulator transition. And indeed, when we, I'll show you the architecture that goes over that, these are the control gates, and this is the SET looking at each island. This is the left SET results here, and this is the right SET results over here. And indeed, you see this beautiful charging diagram, which Faye's already talked about, so I won't say too much about it. If you zoom in and sort of put a fit to that and compare it with modeling, it agrees very well for all the parameters of our device. This is modeled in this code class Captain Simon. And basically, as Faye's explained, as we cross these boundaries, we're adding one electron at a time to the left dot. If we go in this direction, we're adding one electron at a time as we cross these boundaries to the right dot. And if we come down this diagonal direction, we're taking an electron from the left dot and moving it to the right dot without involving the source of runways. In these samples, the source and drain implantation is planned to work, and we're doing these gate voltages here. The fact that we've got this charging diagram was our first real breakthrough. This really said phosphorus in silicon is a very good double quantum dot system. And then you heard from Faye, where Faye took this to a smaller limit in her presentation at this conference, where instead of having our very large clusters, Faye has made these clusters on the nanoscale containing, in this particular result, 600 atoms per cluster, which she also showed you data for 300 atoms per cluster, and basically trying to establish that same charging diagram at this sort of reduced atom level. And as Faye showed you, you know, we can see a similar sort of the hexagonal charging diagram even down at this level. So we're now starting to go from the classical density of states to where discrete states can actually pop out and get into the quantum world. Now, of course, Faye has indicated to you that her plan is to drive this as far as possible by a lot of experimental tricks. Now, there's a gap then between what Faye's going to do and straight to two atoms. So I'm going to go to the bottom end of this, and hopefully we'll make contact somewhere in the middle. But just let me say that this device itself, that the 50-atom quantum dot level could be a very good quantum computing system are very similar to the results of the Japanese group at NTT on gallium arsenide. Okay, so down to now to the measurement data in our lab of, I'm going to talk about 2 and 4 atom data. So getting straight to the results, for some time now in the old architecture we've had this result where as we and we sweep these control gates very quickly and we operate the these SCTs in RF SCT mode and superconducting SCTs, and as we ramp these gate voltages, so if we ramp the gate voltage quickly to try and drive the electron from one atom to the other, having created the charge qubit, what you're looking for is the signature of that electron moving as seen by the SCT. And what we do in ramping the, as we ramp these control gate voltages, we back off that ramp with the SCT gate not shown over here, so that we compensate. So here is the uncompensated Coulomb blockade from the RF SCT, but we want to sit at just one spot, and as we're ramping the drive voltage to get the electron across, we want to stick at that spot, so we counter ramp another gate to sort of balance it out. It's called compensation. So we're sitting at this point, and if no charge transfer occurs, you just get a straight flat line. And what you see here is a very nice little step about the right order of magnitude, 0.02 of an electron, which we interpret as one electron being transferred from one atom to the other. Now, we've reproduced this in the new architecture, and this step is now shown just here. But in this particular sample, you'll note here we swept very quickly and we still saw the step. But here, we actually see the step only when we sweep slowly, and I'll explain this in just a minute. And we've done the sweep rate dependence of this, so this is sweeping at slower and slower speeds. There's also some hysteresis of this device, which we understand, and I won't go into those details for time here. But essentially now, in a couple of devices, and in fact other devices, we can now see what it seems to be reproducibly this one electron transfer in our two atom samples. Okay, now the other thing that you can do here is basically you can sit for example, say that you've got a negative voltage on and your electron is in the left atom. What you can do is you can pulse it very quickly to a point where it wants to go to the right atom. But if it rides up the classical trajectory and stays in the left atom because you've gone too quickly, then the way that it gets back down to the right atom is it relaxes for a phonon process, or a T1 process, for longitudinal acoustic phonons. And so these experiments have been done where we have pulsed beyond the crossing point, delta SAS, from minus 8 volts to plus 8 volts, for example. And so this is 2 volts past the crossing point, 4 volts past the crossing volt, 6 and 8, for example. And then we're looking at the relaxation from the excited state down to the ground state. And when we plot that relaxation time as a function of the excess pulsing voltage behind, away from the zero voltage point where you're in the symmetric and anti-symmetric space, this is a relaxation rate, or T1, that we measure. Now, we've compared this to a theory from Sean Barrett and Gerard Milburn that appeared a few years ago, which where the phonon relaxation rate, the longitudinal acoustic phonon relaxation rate, is given by this formula. As a sinc expression, or a sine x over x expression, the terms in here, most of the terms are fitting parameters for silicon. So this is the deformation potential, this is the reciprocal wave vector that's determined by the particular energy that you sweep to in gate voltage separating the ground and excited states. This is the density of silicon, the speed of light in silicon, for example. So the energy over the speed of light gives you the reciprocal wave vector. And the fitting parameters here is what is the separation between the atoms. And in this particular case, the separation was 50 nanometers. And when we just allowed this to float in this formula, just fitting that parameter, our aperture separation is 50 nanometers, we actually get 50.2 nanometers, which is sort of unusually good and pushing it much too far with our implementation, of course, but nevertheless very satisfying. Now, the other thing that basically occurred is that when we fit the data, we also get agreement for 50 nanometer separation in the expected T1 relaxation time. Now, this is the data, if you just take the raw data from the theory, for a 50 nanometer separation. And what we've done is experimentally, there are a couple of different things that happened. As you sweep through the anti-crossing point, you can get resonant tunneling in the symmetric state. And so, to take allowance of that, we've subtracted off this Lorentzian term here. And then when you go to very high voltage, so that your left atom is got a very steep potential to go to the right atom, so you've got a possibility of coming to a density of states in the conduction band, and so we sort of phenomenologically and with less confidence subtracted that off, of course. Now we get this beautiful agreement, I'll just point out to Jared who hasn't seen this data, but basically this is the structure predicted by theory from the interference of the, when you get integer multiples of this wavelength with the web spacing, etc. And you can see we get peaks and dips and peaks and dips, peak and starting to lose it out here, but if you really nice agreement with theory. So this really, I think, is the first sort of quantitative thing that we've actually started to measure in one of these two-atom samples. So we're looking at relaxation of an engineered two-atom sample showing very good agreement with phonon relaxation theory. So this fitting was done by Søren Andersen. Okay, now I wanted to sort of explain a little bit then what are we doing here? So what I've just described, if I start off by saying here's the generic energy levels of my two-atom qubit, our potentials of these 1 over R potentials for single phosphorus atoms in silicon. Why are we going for single phosphorus atoms in silicon? Because in this 1 over R potential, the excited states are a long way away, and there's basically no spin orbit coupling. We're giving an extremely long spin relaxation time. That's why it's worth all the weight and all the effort. I'll come on to that. And so, for example, here in the zero voltage state, you have balanced swirls. The ground state is symmetric and the excited state is anti-symmetric. Over here at negative gate voltage, the ground state becomes localized in the left well with the excited state in the right well. And over here, the ground state is in the right well, a positive voltage for the excited state in the left well. So what I've just described to you is in the first sample, we moved an electron from here to here and measured it with our OCT. In the second sample, for reasons which I'll explain in a minute, when we did this, we moved quickly up to here. We didn't actually manage to do that trajectory. And then we had to do a T1 relaxation up to the ground state, which we fitted to the data, fitted to the theory. Now, why are these two samples different? And the answer is that it's likely that in the first sample, our atoms are close together, so that we have a big gap and this sort of rather flat trajectory, so that when you're pulsing quickly, you still stay on this trajectory. But in the second sample, with this 50 nanometer separation, we're in this regime with a steeper and smaller gap. And when you sweep quickly, you sort of go up the classical trajectory to here in the pulse, and then you have to relax via frontals. So although we had a slow sample, it enabled us to probe some very beautiful theory. Okay. Now, the next thing we want to do is to bring on microwaves, and so we'd like to do microwave absorption experiments just like the superconducting qubits to observe sideband absorption. And so just going back one, let me just flick it back for a minute. Without the microwaves, this is your SET signal, and with the microwaves, what you're looking for in the SET signal are these sideband absorption peaks. And what I'm plotting here is the probability, for example, of being in the left well, so you start off in this state, and then as you vary your gate voltage with this fixed microwave frequency on, when you come into resonance, you get the sideband absorption going down towards 0.5, because when you have these microwaves on, you're driving Rabi oscillations in the system, and so you've got a DC voltage that you're at here away from zero, and you've got your AC electric field of your microwaves, and then if you look at your wave function, you have this sine squared omega Rabi T, and so you're forcing your electron to oscillate up and down here. And if you observe these sidebands effectively, this is a signature of coherent control of your qubit. So you're driving Rabi oscillations. And then, of course, as you keep going, you see the absorption on the other side, and this sort of sideband structure is a signature that you have a qubit, basically. Okay, so let me now go on to the microwave spectroscopy. But I'd just like to advertise some of Lloyd's work with Sankar Dasama and Cameron. But basically, they calculated what the sideband should look like for small deviations from ideal, this is the sort of regime that we're in by an implantation, for significantly different separations, which I'll come to, and for various modes of decoherence. Now, the most important point here, and this is what sort of just held us up a little for the time being, is that all of our 2-atom samples of batch we've got at the moment have a 50 nanometer separation. And a 50 nanometer separation, unfortunately, the theory tells us it's going to be extremely hard to see that sideband. And so when we switched the microwaves on this sample, we didn't see the sideband. So we then thought, okay, we've made some samples with 4 atoms, and there is an opportunity where 2 of those atoms may have gone down the same hole, and with a straddle, their separation will be within range to see sideband absorption. It'll be more complicated than the 2-atom system because it will be dressed by the other 2 phosphorus atoms. Okay, so if we go to this, the next nice thing that Lloyd and Cam have done is that we realize that when we are away from the crossing point at negative or positive voltages, we're in localized states. And there is not a matrix element E dot B between these localized states. So your sideband matrix elements fade as you move away from the anti-crossing point. And so you won't see these sidebands going out in frequency forever. They'll fade out of you because your matrix element is going to zero as you go to localized states. And so this is what you expect to see in the data as you plot gate voltage as a function of frequency, and that's what I'm going to show you. And I've actually calculated the sort of structure that you're going to see. It's small. Okay, it's not quite like the superconducting qubit case. This is a delicate experiment, and so we have to sort of try and dig this data out. Okay, and the final thing I'd like to say, coming on to Sean and Tom, who are both here at Sean Barrett and Tom Stace, who are both here, is that they've told us how we can get the decoherence rate out of this data in an ideal situation. So if you have this sideband structure, and this was done for our particular charged qubit, but if you plot the height of this peak as a function of the width of this peak, which is this blue curve, just ignore the red curve, which relates to the Rabi frequency on the same plot, then it has this sort of shape. In other words, the peak comes up sort of narrow, it increases in height and fairly constant width, and then it broadens and sort of saturates. And the formula for this, if you plot the height versus the width, you can pull out the dephasing rate, which is what everybody wants to know. And that's sort of where we're getting. Okay. Now, coming on to experiment, the premise in the experiment, you heard a lovely talk from Andrew about his Cooper pair transistor structures and doing microwave spectroscopy. What Andrew didn't have time to cover, so let me just say this, is that he has also measured a Cooper pair box. So we've repeated the Chalmers Yale experiments by building a Cooper pair box, looking at it with an SCT, and in a 0 to 40 gigahertz experiment, have mapped out these microwave sidebands. This is a 2E step. This is quasi-particle poisoning. So here are the sidebands. You study them as a function of frequency. They form a linear plot. And basically, what this tells us is, if there's a qubit down there, we have at least the setup in microwaves to measure this properly before we go into single atom samples, because you don't know what goes wrong if you see nothing in single atom samples. This tells us that the experimental setup is probably good. And we learned a lot by doing that experiment. Okay, so now coming on to the microwave spectroscopy. This work was done by Dr. Rolf Brenner, here's our microwave architecture, so microwaves coming down this line, as is our DC voltages. And with this 4-atom sample, one model, for example, is that 2 atoms have gone down this hole but are too far apart to see microwave absorption, but these 2 atoms may be close enough to see microwave absorption. Another model would be 1 phosphorus atom here, 3 over here containing 1 charged qubit, 4004 is very improbable. We've characterized the SET to start off with. It's actually a fairly low tunnel barrier resistance, reasonably small charging energy, an okay sensitivity to do the experiment. But the really interesting thing that came out of this is the care that was taken to do this experiment. Now, Rolf had his training in Tübingen, and he has an extremely thorough German approach to do this experiment. And what he did was he wanted to ensure that at every single frequency, the microwave power was constant at the bottom of the fridge at the cubit. So we weren't looking at fluctuations in microwave power. How did he do that? He used the SET as a calibration source. So for every single frequency, we worked out how much power you put down to bring the Coulomb blockade to 0.5 of its peak value. And you trigger off that. You plot this data. At low powers, we use a 30 dB attenuator. At high powers, a 10 dB attenuator. And basically, this data takes 72 hours for this sample to accumulate. Very, very careful. And then we put that into a computer, and that gets fed into our experiment. Okay. First thing in the device, and now the 4-atom device, did you see a single charged trunk sort of corresponding to a charged qubit? The answer is yes. And looking over, this is a small voltage range, but from minus a half a volt to plus half a volt, this is the only structure in town. It's 0.012 of an electron. It's got the right order of magnitude. It's very clean. This is an average, obviously an average signal. And so at least we have this charged qubit in range. Do we see microwave spectroscopy? Yes. Here is the data. What I showed you before, this is 15 to 40 gigahertz. You can see here this sort of fading structure that looks very like the calculations. This is differentiated data. What you don't expect to see is this folding back, but we're interpreting this as due to the four-atom nature as opposed to the two-atom nature of this experiment. You can sort of fit lines to this data. In particular, I'm interested in these lines here that are fanning out. We studied this data. This is in the 0 to 20 gigahertz range, where there's really less to see. You just start to see the real thing coming up just below 20 gigahertz. Again, you can try and fit lines to this data. It's quite complicated. We've studied the power dependence. So this is going out to P equals 1 is the 50% destruction of the Coulomb blockade peak point that I talked about. These are lower power, so we can watch how this develops as a function of the power. We can see how this, this is at 0 to 20 gigahertz. I won't say too much. This is not an interesting frequency range. We've looked at the magnetic field dependence, which is rather interesting, and I must say we don't understand this. But what actually happens, the features are, is that the actual spectroscopy narrows with magnetic field, and this slope corresponds to about 0.02 millielectron volts per Tesla, which is about right for an electron, but we need to think about that a little more. And we've done the temperature dependence, and the reason that this fades, this is our detector just fading with temperature because we have a high charge energy. Not a lot happens in temperature. We just lose the data at high temperature, basically. And that's because our step, as seen by the SET, which is our detector, is fading away on us because of the charging energy of this particular device. And I'd just like to just take a closer look at this data in the interesting regime and just show you some tips to this. Let me just flip this here. Basically, this is the sort of thing that was calculated theoretically. We're interpreting this as a fading of the side bands due to the matrix elements going to localized states. If I look at that data and that data, the structure that I'm looking at here is up, down over here. It's got a side band light event. Here, where we only have a single point, we don't see that structure. And up here, for example, where we're looking here and here, we're seeing an up and then a down, if you will. The structure, you know, is not pristine, but you know, bear in mind what we're trying to measure here is very delicate. And so we have a little way to go in understanding this data, and it's complicated because it's four atoms. And so when we get to two atoms, I think we'll be in business. Okay, so we also have an anti-crossing effect, which we looked at. This is one of these two-level system crossings that John Martinis has seen in his spectroscopy. You can see it really here, this sort of anti-crossing effect of 38.4 gigahertz. This came in when we thermally cycled the sample, so everything was reproducible with thermal cycling. This is very good. But this little, we're interpreting this as a trap that's come in, and this trap is crossing our level spectroscopy, for example. That's actually a very good sign, even though you don't want the trap. And we studied this as a function of magnetic field, power, and it's got a very interesting structure. It's like a lighthouse, this thing, when it comes through. Here is the step. You just start to see it come through. It comes through as a very big peak, then dies away as you move down here. seems to have three levels. It's rather complicated, and we need to try and analyse that a little bit more time. A few other things before I finish. Towards a couple qubits, you've heard this, you've seen this poster, I should say, by two of our students, Malam Nikki and Maya Cassidy, and basically, instead of having a double large double dot system, they've coupled two double dots, and basically, what they're trying to see is quantum side of your atomic. So if you put a voltage on here, what you want to do is to move this electron, and then due to the capacitive coupling of the upper dot, to get this QCA effect of an electron switching in the upper dot. And this is exactly what Lloyd has published as what we want to see on our coupling of charge qubits shown here. So this is towards charge qubit coupling at the classical level. Absolutely beautiful data. I should just say that the upper quantum dots and tunnel barriers are about 100 nanometers, but the spacing here is 300 nanometers so that we don't get tunneling between the two double dot systems, they're capacitively coupled. This is a charging diagram for the upper double dot, charging diagram for the lower double dot, and essentially by sweeping the lower dot through here by moving an electron from here to here, coming down this diagonal trajectory which I've explained, and by biasing this upper dot just at a critical point, fractions of millivolts below where it needs to go, you see the switching as this comes this way. That one switches that way due to plastic coupling. And you see this in the data. Here's the this electron going, and this is followed beautifully by the other electron going. And the sensors is all right. They're both sitting on the right side of the column, blockade peak and so on. It's beautiful work. And the thing that I'll say about this in the spirit of the conference away from quantum computing, there's absolutely no reason why this can't be reduced to the single atom level, which should operate at room temperature. So this is single atom QCA at room temperature, very much on the horizon. Putting aside quantum computing, because of the confinement energies of the single atom. Okay, so now, another thing that I'd like to mention is some work of CERN Anderson towards spin measurement, and basically same architecture, but something slightly different, the Schottky contact coming down the middle. Now, we all know about this beautiful experiment done by Leo Kuvenhagen at Delft, and Lawrence Van Beveren, the student who did this work, one electron in a quantum dot, an adjacent reservoir, a quantum point contact sensor, a fast gate line, and through a whole sequence of pulses, which I haven't got time to explain, a measurement of single spin. Now, the equivalent of that for us is basically one atom with one electron in phosphorus corresponding to the dot, a fast gate line corresponding to this line here, an adjacent reservoir, but this reservoir has to be well defined, no straddle, it's got to be a well abrupt reservoir, and that's why we've gone from Schottky, platinum suicide, forming an abrupt reservoir here. To test these devices, we've made structures, put a gate in the middle, operated as a nano MOSFET, and basically, the progress so far is to implant 50 atoms here, and so ideally we want to make sure that the single spin of that one atom in an identical experiment for this. And in fact, Lawrence Van Beveren will be joining us as a new postdoc in our group at the end of this month to take part in this experiment. Now basically, what's been done so far, instead of just looking at one electron case, one atom, we backed off to start with and looked at 50 atoms, and here we can see the individual electron transfers to this very abrupt reservoir. Several scans through different scans of data showing this periodic electron transfer from our cluster. So we're all set to go, very close to taking on single spins of single atom analysis to Delft. Okay, now I'm just about finished, Jeremy, so now coming on to here, why are nanotropic contacts important? And how will we really go to spin besides spin measurement? And basically, what we want to do is to have two atoms, but we want to have source and drain leads. But these source and drain leads, unlike phase samples, can't be ionic imparted because of the struggle. They need to be abrupt. And so our plan is to have abrupt source-drain nanoschottky contacts addressing two atoms, which puts us in the identical Harvard structure, the triplet singlet spin qubit. And I'll finish on that note in a minute. just to say that another thing that's going on with spin measurement was a poster from Dane McCaney, basically showing that by building nanostructures with a little gap and putting phosphorus atoms into the gap, we can see a phosphorus signal, and I'm sorry for racing through this because of the time, it really doesn't do justice to Dane's work, but we can see a phosphorus signal if we implant just 50 atoms in the gap. And so we can basically, we're down to 50 atom sensitivity almost without trying by making a 100 nanometer gap in these very phosphorus nanostructures and looking at the EDMR signal. And our plan is here to implant one atom into these buried leads, which give us EDMR geometry. But these leads will be arsenic, so we don't have to worry about the straggle because the arsenic resonance is outside of the phosphorus window. And so the plan is using our single-ion detector technologies to put one atom between this nanostructure, and we think we've got enough sensitivity to measure its spin in EDMR. Okay, so just to finish and conclude, this is my last slide. Where are we actually going for the spin resonance, for the spin qubit? So this you'll be familiar with from Charlie Marcus. This is a two-atom double quantum dot system with source drain leads. So two electron in the double quantum dot with source drain leads. This is, you can see here, two electrons on the right dot, one in the left, one in the right dot. And this has been this beautiful experiment demonstrating a single triplet spin qubits. So what we want to do is to replicate this with two atoms containing an electron each with source drain leads. We need to establish the charge phasing diagram beyond the 300 atom level that Fay is at down to the two atom level. This is a D minus center, so we'll need a gate to confine it. And then we hope to replicate what Harvey's done with phosphorus and silicon, where the relaxation time is expected to be going somewhere beyond 100 milliseconds for the spin qubit. Same architecture, this is a single spin EDMR experiment with source drain leads. And I'll stop there.
Hey, we do have lunch on now, and I'd ask you to use that as an opportunity to ask Bob some questions if you have any. So could you join me in thanking all of the speakers in our final session?
Can I just hold another for a minute? Nothing to do with physics now. I asked earlier if I could just say a few words at the end on behalf of all of us. I'm sure you would like me to do this. I think this has been a wonderful conference, and I think it's noble that we should thank our organisers. First and foremost, I'd like to thank Anna and Sally, who've done a marvellous job in all the logistic arrangements for this conference. And secondly, and most importantly, I'd like to thank Jared and Phil for organising such a wonderful conference. For me, the really nice thing about this is Jared and Phil, as we know, both had a tremendous generosity and spirit with regard to physics and sharing of results and collaboration and trying to understand basic science. Phil was trying to get a lot of international collaboration going through the PIP structure. And I think this whole conference, to me, has been characterized by that tremendous goodwill, sharing our data, talking about our science, which I think characterizes the quantum information, quantum nanoscience community. Long may it be so. I really thank all the international people for coming this long way to Australia for this conference. But once again, to Jared and Phil, thank you very much.
For the following six people, see me as soon as possible, please. Firestark, Cochran, Oxtoby, Schofield, Ho, and Gilmore. Thank you very much.